Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, will be interviewing James Corbett of the Corbett Report here right after the first segment of the program, so please make sure you stay tuned for that great interview. And for the first 20 minutes, you're going to hear my opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Thursday, November 6, 2014. And today, well, first let's get started right into the market report. And let's see what we had with gold. We have a little bit of a thunderstorm going through here in central Pennsylvania, so the possibilities of power outages might exist. So if for some reason we go off the air here shortly, we'll still be able to pick up, you'll still be able to hear the interview with James Corbett here in the first segment. So just giving everyone a warning that the possibility is there. Gold today, not a lot of lightning there with gold. It didn't get struck down today. We were managed to get up about $2.70 today at $1,143. We have silver up 14 at $1,556. Platinum was down 13 at $1,199, and palladium was down 8 at $753. And of course, the big story when it comes to silver is product. And I mean, there are silver rounds available, and it's just, you know, the mint, the reason they run out is due to incompetency. I saw where they had manufactured some year 2015 Silver Eagles, and that's probably what they were doing. They started making their 2015s and got behind on 2014s, and now all of a sudden they're out of them. But certainly demand has been very strong, so not to take away that from the amount of purchasing of Silver Eagles. So particularly after the month of October, when you have over 5 million ounces of 1 ounce silver eagles being sold, that's an incredible, incredible number for the month, and it was the second month over 5 million for the year. So somebody's buying it up, and I mentioned it before. Since back in March, when they sold the 5 million, you also saw silver prices drop at that time. So I know it doesn't sort of go together, but certainly if you're interested in getting picking up some Silver Eagles, I would be doing it very quickly with December coming on and the switchover from 1 year to the next. There's always delays, so you could see some delays. And, of course, we will lock in prices for you, but once the delay gets too long, we will no longer do that. So give us a call. We got still got some really great prices for Silver Eagles 2014s. Give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. Let's go ahead and go on with the markets. The Dow was up 67 points. Well, before we get to those paper markets, let's look at the USDX. This is another amazing number, up 0.64 at 88.06. 88.06 on the USDX. Now, they have gold up $2. That's an incredible strength for gold. We'll have to see if it goes through and follows through tomorrow, but certainly having the U.S. dollar at 88.06, amazing, up 0.64. Crude oil down 72 at 77.96. And we also have in the paper markets, let's go ahead and do that. You still have the euphoria from the election and, of course, the European Central Bank, and we'll be talking about that here in just a few minutes. The Dow was up 69 points at 17,554. The NASDAQ up 17 at 46.38, and the S&P up 7 at 2,031. The 10-year yield up 0.02 at 2.38%. And some of the news, of course, is the European Central Bank earlier today, they decided to keep its interest rates on hold at a record low, a 0.05%. And, of course, that did help the euro go lower. And, of course, that we saw the strength in the U.S. dollar today. And they had already announced that they were going to buy private debt and issue long-term loans. And the stimulus is going to be $1.25 trillion. In euros, it's 1 trillion euros. Now, it's amazing when trillion dollars is no longer a big number. It really is a big number, but yet they need these trillions and trillions of dollars just to keep these economies going. Do you really believe it's going to work? Do you think our Federal Reserve on what they have on their balance sheet, spending $4 trillion, you think that's going to work? We're barely making it? I mean, it is incredible. And it's like, oh, what's another $1 trillion? Oh, the markets go up and everybody's happy. Don't worry. Be happy. It's all about today. It's not about tomorrow. It's not about next week, a year from now, or 5 years. It's not about our future. It is about today, what they need to do today to keep things going. They slashed their forecast. The European officials slashed their forecast for the Eurozone growth to just 0.8% for 2014. They projected inflation of just 0.6. Yeah, I bet if you ask those Europeans what they thought their inflation rate was, I'll guarantee you they probably think it's a lot higher, just like we do here. And of course, the ECB, just like the Federal Reserve, their target for inflation is 2%. You know, that's their little magic number. The ECB conditions, we expect that the a senior economist out of Berenberg Bank said they expect the ECB conditions for more easing will be met. Well, of course, they're falling apart over there. And they're going to have full-bore quantitative easing. It's going to include purchases of sovereign debt. And we'll just see how much of an impact it has on the European countries. Probably very similar to the great economy that we have here that everybody is so proud to say. But if you look to the October, the Challenger Gray and Christmas, their report for the number of planned layoffs by U.S. employers surged nearly 70% in October. It surged nearly 70% after falling to a 14-year low in September. Employers plan to cut 51,000 jobs in October, up significantly from the 30,000 from the previous month, and the second highest reading this year. And of course, the retail sector, which is the consumer, led the job losses with almost 6,900 planned layoffs, more than three times the cuts announced in September. And we're heading into the holiday season. So I guess they are planning perhaps, but even if they do online selling, you still need to have the people to take the orders, to process the orders, to ship the orders, to gather the orders. So you still need the people when you have an increase even on online purchasing. You still need bodies to process this stuff. So to see these cuts right before the season, you know, again, gives you question of just how great this economy they tell us it is. You hear a lot of people talk about the robust auto sales in October. And there's a lot of contradictions if you care to read and care to understand what some of these reports are. And auto sales, it was brisk, up 6% from a year earlier, and running at the annual pace of almost 16.5 million vehicles. The estimated average transaction price, and this is what people actually pay for new cars and trucks, was $32,957. So we'll round that out to $33,000 in October. And that was up almost $800 from a year ago. And up $870 just from September. And this was according to True Car. Now, the average transaction prices is up and shows that people are more willing to pay more for a more expensive automobile. How can they pay for a much higher priced automobile and trucks when things are a little bit tough? Well, you have to look to the length of the loan. The average new car loan in October was 67 months. That's the second longest on record. And that's according to Edmunds.com. So if things were really great, then you would have the October, you wouldn't have these long-term loans. And of course, the long loans make everything seem affordable by reducing those monthly payments. So some of the elements that factored into October sales could actually wind up undoing the industry. It might be more of a negative impact than a positive one. Those six-year borrowers, they're going to be out of the market a very long time. And when you have loans that long, these new vehicles depreciate faster than the loan that you're paying off. So even if you decide, well, you know, I'm tired of this car, instead of 67 months, I want to get rid of it in half the amount. If you want to trade it in, let's say after 4 years on a new one, you're going to owe a lot more on that vehicle than what the vehicle is worth. So what are you going to have to do? These people, and again, these are all these subprime loans that now you're going to see in the auto industry. You're going to have, or they will have to finance the negative equity on their trade on top of the purchase price for the new one. And you know, America's love affair with automobiles, they will continue to keep buying. And so you don't know. And if they can't afford that, then what are they going to do? Get a 70-month loan? 75-month loan? I mean, heck, cars are priced at the what you could buy a home back in the 1960s. You could buy a home for $35,000. And now your automobiles, many of them are priced much higher than that. So, you know, maybe they'll have a 15-year loan for your automobile. Who knows? But, I mean, it is incredible. And these are not signs of a good, strong, healthy economy. It's not a sign of a good, strong, healthy consumer. Our economy is based on consumers buying, buying, and buying. And these are just all the signs. Take them at will and use them however you may. We also have fuel prices that have been volatile. So if the current downward price slide reverses again, which I'm sure it will, you're going to have all these high-priced, high-profit SUVs and trucks that now everybody's starting to buy. You're starting to see them increase because of these low gasoline prices. Once that's reversed, we saw it once before, that you're going to have a glut of these large vehicles on these dealers' lots reduced values. And what will that do? That will hamper the industry's growth. So you're seeing, again, we know that history does repeat itself. And this is just an example of the auto industry. You had sale incentives. And we'll just keep finished talking about these automobiles because it's important. Because they often, slam these automobile numbers in your face to make you think that, oh, people are out there buying these automobiles, and they are. But if you look a little bit further, it's not as rosy as it seems. You have sales incentives. They've averaged almost a little over $2,600 per vehicle. And the ratio to average transaction price was 7.9%, down from 9.3%. So the transaction price gains have continued to outstrip the incentive spending. So that is good news for profit margins for these companies. And, we have a breakdown on the different vehicles. One of the ones, the Chevy Volt, $35,000 Chevy Volt, it's a hybrid. Extended range electric, that fell almost 29%. And a lot of your hybrids, the interest is no longer there. You know, once you see these dropping gasoline prices, you think somebody's going to go out there and buy a hybrid? No, they're not going to do that at all. They'll keep with the gas guzzlers. So you see all the pressure on these vehicles, like the Toyota's Prius. Their sales was off nearly 14%. And I read where GM was going to bring the Volt back to the States. Currently, they're being made in Mexico, and they haven't made a dime on these Volts yet. I hear, they can be great and all this kind of stuff, but they're still, it's a losing proposition, these Volts. Now they're bringing them back to the States, and I'm thinking to myself, well, if you're losing money on a vehicle that's being made in Mexico, how are you going to reverse that by bringing it back to the States? It's good for a few jobs here in this country. No, not upset about that. But here you have a company that came out of bankruptcy making bad decisions. So if you're already having a losing proposition on a vehicle, how are you going to gain when you have the labor that you're going to have to increase here in the States? So how is that going to profit GM on this one particular vehicle? So, it's just a bunch of nonsense. Genworth Financial Inc., their shares plummeted today after the financial services and insurance company, they posted a large and unexpected, I love these unexpected third quarter losses. I'll guarantee you, if you're posting a large loss, there's no loss that's unexpected. If you're running a company, you know exactly what your loss is going to be. But they reported an adjusted loss of 64 cents per share versus earnings of 28 cents per share a year earlier, and the loss surprised these investors and analysts. They've all been anticipating earnings of 16 cents per share. This is why I bring this to you. The company said late Wednesday that the loss is due to an increase in reserves for its long-term care claims. People getting old, well, they're going to be dying soon, so with the Obamacare, and goodwill impairments tied to its life and long-term care insurance business. So again, it's the cost of healthcare, but we were all told that things would be better. But they also had an area where they didn't disclose exactly what it was. to where they just, you know, written it off. And I was just wondering if maybe these were not losses on derivatives. You know, when you have a financial company and their shares plummeted and they can blame it on the long-term care insurance. But my thought was, I wonder, just perhaps they were hit a little bit harder on the maybe the derivative markets. As we've seen these markets change in this last quarter, we've had some big drops. They've come back. You've seen drops in the bond, 10-year bond, and you know perhaps the assets that were backing these derivatives, perhaps it had an impact. And I think we're out of time. 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you enjoy the interview with Alfred Adask and James Corbett. We'll be back, or I'll be back tomorrow.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family. American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
It's Wednesday night, and that means it's time for James Corbett. James is the author of the Corbett Report at CORBETTREPORT.com, CorbettReport.com. Publication he's had out for, I don't remember, I have it down here someplace, 2007. Outlet for Independent Critical Analysis of Politics, Society, History, and Economics. Also editorial writer for the International Forecaster, which was started by now-deceased Bob Chapman. Always look forward to having James on the program. Hello, James. How are things in Japan?
Well, they're pretty good, but I must admit I'm a little bit offended you don't have that spiel down pat and memorized by now, Alfred.
I'm getting old, James. You know, I mean, I'm working on trying to remember the password for my computer. I can't keep up with the other things as much as I might like to. Here's something from iKnow.com News. Japan's $1.1 trillion public pension fund okays plan to boost share purchases, pair bonds. In other words, they're going to start buying shares in the stock market rather than keeping bonds from the government, or perhaps corporate bonds, but I think they're dumping government bonds, I'm going to assume, and we'll find out from James in a moment. Japan's $1.1 trillion public pension fund approved a plan on Friday to double its holdings of shares and cut back sharply on bonds to help improve investment returns. Of course, they're going to have to take greater risk to get better. They will get better investment returns in theory from stocks than they will from bonds, but they will assume greater risk also, and meet its obligation to a swelling number of retirees. Is this a good idea? Is this smart? Or is this evidence of desperation?
Well, this is Abenomics at any rate. I think this is ultimately what they've been seeking to accomplish for a while, which is to get the stock market ignited. And so they've been desperately pumping money into that stock market quite directly mm-hmm. through the Bank of Japan, which, unlike other central banks, which try to hide their investment and manipulation of stock markets, the Bank of Japan is quite open with theirs. They buy both REITs, the real estate investment trusts, and ETFs, electronic exchange traded funds that are linked specifically to the Nikkei 400, the Nikkei 225. So they have a specific agenda of boosting the stock market, and they've been doing that pretty well. The Nikkei boosted quite a bit last week on a somewhat surprise decision. I don't think a lot of people saw it coming necessarily, to increase the amount of quantitative easing they're doing here in Japan, which is already quite a large amount with 50 trillion yen of purchases for the year that was slated for the Bank of Japan to pump into the economy they've upped that to now 80 trillion for the year. So that's a sizable increase, and they're going to triple their REIT and ETF purchases. So they're flooding a whole bunch of new money into the markets. And again, this had the immediate effect of boosting the Nikkei stock index. So mission accomplished. And as part of this, the Japanese public pension fund, the largest pension fund in the world, as you say, over $1 trillion that they're playing around with, is now basically moving out of government bonds and into stocks. So mission accomplished in that sense. Although it does really, I mean, for a country that relies on the public to finance the debt of the government, which is at, last I checked, over 250% of GDP, which is an incredibly high debt burden, debt ratio. For a country that relies on the public to buy these bonds, it's, I think, somewhat worrying that now even the pension fund, the largest pension fund, which has been a reliable and sturdy and steady buyer of Japanese government bonds, is moving out of that and into the stock market. So I don't know how Japan expects it's going to be financing its debt obligations in the future as fewer and fewer people are purchasing Japanese government bonds, but it will be interesting to see what results from this, and interesting is a word that can mean a lot of different things. Unfortunately, absolutely. I think it has some negative connotations in this context for the average Japanese, because of course, whatever manipulations are going on in the stock market to make these, you know, Nikkei indexes and all of these phony baloney numbers higher, what it actually means in the economy is very little so far. This is not translated into much in the way of economic activity, as real wages in Japan continue to decline, as retail sales continue to slump because of higher taxes and all sorts of problems that underlie the economy. The only bright spot really for Japan right now is plunging oil prices, which is good for a net energy importer like Japan.
I understand. Then this, the idea that they are supposedly doing this to ensure future, it's being able to pay future obligations to retirees, is that a pretext? Is a real reason to shore up the stock market? Or is this a little of both,
No, I think it. I mean, there is an actual sense to that, because of course Japanese government bonds do not pay very much at all. I don't know what the current rates are, but very anemic returns, which generally Japanese investors have been happy with. The small and steady returns that you can bank on is kind of the Japanese mindset. But in now that the Nikkei is soaring, I mean, it soared 4.8% in one day last week on the news of that BOJ injection. I mean, clearly the returns to be made are in the stock market at this point. So I guess if the pension fund really is interested in protecting the assets of its investors, its pension contributors, then it really does have to be in the stock market at this point. Again, this is a case of government intervention or Bank of Japan intervention, making people have certain decisions in how they invest their money, which is really, I mean, the idea of how the economy is driven in this central banking age. The central banks get to decide what you do with your money, ultimately, because they decide the price of money, they decide whether the stock markets are going up or down, because they get to decide monetary policy, which influences that quite directly. So again, it's a heavily dictated reality, but it is a reality nonetheless. If you want to be making profits in the short term here in Japan, you should be in the stock market at the moment.
It makes us wonder, where is reality, and does reality even factor in, or can we run the economies of the world just based on somebody snapping their fingers and saying, ta-da, we're going to pay this interest rate or whatever? But can an economy really be controlled? Is central planning going to work for any economy, really?
Certainly not in the long run, but there is a period of time in which you can deceive the long run and make them short-term benefits. And it, again, it goes back to what we were talking about last week with perception and reality. But yeah, I think an underlying point about what money is that a lot of people don't really appreciate is that money fundamentally is trust. I mean, it relies on the trust of the people who are using and exchanging whatever passes for money in an economy. So in a day and age where people trust the U.S. dollar or they trust the Japanese yen to be what it is and to be exchangeable, then people will continue using it, even though it's being manipulated, and quite openly so. There comes a point at which that trust starts to evaporate when the changes happening in the economy start to become too great. And when that happens, it's an abrupt change. As trust is lost, that starts a snowball effect. And depending on how big the bubble has been blown is how much pain will be suffered when that bubble is popped. And unfortunately, as we've been talking about for a long time here on this program, it is a very, very, very large bubble at this point, and sure, that means that equals a lot of pain for the average person who is going to be living through that bubble pop at some point.
And when you say the bubble is large, huge, likely to be painful when it pops, are we talking only about a bubble that impacts Japan right now, or are we talking about a bubble that may be global in size?
Well, there's no maybe about it. The largest bond bubble in history has been blown by the central banks of not only the United States with their quantitative easing in the Federal Reserve System, not only in the Bank of England with their quantitative easing, and not only in Japan with their quantitative easing, but many other places besides have been engaging in this currency war to try to pump money into the system to devalue their currencies in the trade war that's going on underneath the surface of all of this. And it's been openly admitted. A quote that I go back to quite a bit is Andrew Haldane of the Bank of England, who said that they have intentionally blown the biggest bond bubble in history. And that's pretty worrying talk coming from a Bank of England policymaker who's relatively high up and has the position to know what he's talking about.
Are all of the nations and central banks that are currently involved in pumping this bubble up, there seems to be, there's a unanimity in everybody's trying to blow this bubble up. Does this signal that it's the only thing they've got to do, or are they anticipating that it's going to pop? Are they putting as much debt as possible into the bubble and just anticipating we're going to pull the plug on this thing and we're going to wipe it all out? Do you follow what I'm saying? Is this bubble, is it being done as a pretext to a reset?
Well, I think then we have to start speculating about the intentions of the people who are doing this, and that can be difficult to do because obviously I'm not a mind reader. We can listen to their public statements and we can look at history and we can try to parse how this has happened in the past. I mean, you could make an argument that this is that what they are doing right now in trying to provide as much liquidity as possible is the right thing to be doing, because the exact opposite tack was taken back in 1929 when the stock market collapsed and basically the Fed sat back and let the money supply contract as the banks started sucking that money out of the economy, calling in their loans and not issuing any new ones. And that started the sort of chain reaction of collapses and closures and business grinding to a halt. It's called the Great Monetary Contraction of 1929 to 1933. Most people think that the Depression started with the stock market collapse, but it was really the contraction of the money supply between 1929 and 33 that really started the Depression proper. And so in the 2008 collapse, they took the exact opposite approach. They started throwing money hand over fist at the banks to try to keep that liquidity in the system so that the banks could continue issuing loans and basically the monetary supply wouldn't contract. And in some ways, I mean, you get people like at the Telegraph and Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who is someone who, of all of the mainstream commentators on economy, I take probably the most seriously. He's done some great work in the past. And so he had an interesting take on the end of quantitative easing, Federal Reserve style, where basically he said it's been, in one sense, you could say it's been a success insofar as it avoided that type of monetary contraction and the ensuing Great Depression type of depression that we saw in the 1929-1933 period. But then, of course, it's the consequences of that and how they unwind from that is going to be the real deal. So that's in an article that he wrote called QE Central Bankers Deserve a Medal for Saving Society, which if you actually read the article, it's not quite so laudatory, and it does bring up some of those questions. So there is an argument to be made that this was the only thing that could be done within the parameters of the current system, and that's kind of the sticking point of this, because we are in the system where this money is created ultimately at the top through the central bank feeding money into the banks, and then the banks feeding it down to the people below. And when you're in that system, there's only so many ways that you can act, and it's kind of what they say with when you're faced with a problem, all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And that's kind of what happens when you have a catastrophic banking collapse in a system which is dictated by the central bank. All the central bank can do is put money into the system or take it out. So it put money in hand over fist. And,
but did they really put it into the system? Because in a sense similar to the Great Depression, if the Great Depression was caused by the bankers taking money out of the system, in theory, the Federal Reserve with quantitative easing was pumping money in theory into the system, but they said, we're going to give it to you bankers and you distribute it to the great unwashed out there in TV land. But by and large, bankers didn't do that. We didn't really get that money, didn't get into circulation, at least not in the United States.
No, that
they sat on it. It's not like pulling the money out of the economy, but they didn't allow the excess money to come into the economy to the extent that some assumed would take place.
Well, this is really the point of what they did, which was not to basically buy people's mortgages out or giving aid directly to the people. What they did was bail out the banks by taking their mortgage-backed securities and other toxic assets off of their balance sheets and parking it at the Federal Reserve, meaning that the Fed now has trillions of dollars of these useless assets and has pumped that into the banks, which have not really passed that down to the consumers in the form of loans to the extent that that would have occurred if that money had been given directly to people. Now, again, there's the argument to be made, well, if you give it directly to the people and they start spending it among each other, that causes inflation. That would have been the hyperinflationary cycle that that people have often talked about. That's why inflation hasn't happened in the last few years to the extent that people would expect it to, with the trillions of dollars that have been created, because those trillions of dollars didn't go directly into the economy. They went into the banks and basically have been more or less parked there. So, again, it's not an easy nut to crack, and it's not over.
We don't even know. We're still in the first, maybe the second act of this play, but we are nowhere near the end of it. We don't know how this drama is going to work out.
We certainly don't, but we have some good indications of which way it's heading, and those indications come from the various statistics that show that, again, things like labor participation rate, again, down near 30, 40-year lows, and food stamps, again, more Americans on food stamps than ever before, and all of the other, little signs that tend to get glossed over in the mainstream economic reporting that indicate fundamental problems with the way that the system is functioning. Now, double the amount of global billionaires to what there was in 2008, 2009, not because there's been a general increase in the economy generally, but just because there's been a greater concentration of money. And that process continues to happen. And it doesn't show any signs of reversing. I think that concentration is only likely to accelerate as the Fed unwinds from its bubble creation.
And the net result, fewer people have money to spend. In theory, that means there's going to be less revenue for businesses. Prices are going to fall. Taxes are going to fall. Less revenue for government. We're not out of the woods on this yet, but we're going to take a break for some commercials, and I'll be back with James Corbett in just a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm Alfred Adams.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in an untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk here on Financial Survival, talking with James Corbett, who's calling in from Japan. James is the author, editor, producer of The Corbett Report, CORBETTREPORT.com. Independent critical analysis of one thing or another. I've got a couple of the words there, Jim. I couldn't remember all the words. This is it's definitely worth your time. Take a look. Corbett Report, CORBETTREPORT.com. We had an election yesterday. The Democrats were hammered badly. They've been routed. And not just the Democrats in general, but President Obama in particular, I'm not sure what effect this is going to have on politics in this country over the course of the next 2 years. I don't know that getting a Republican majority into both the House and the Senate is going to change things in a dramatic way in this country. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But I'm curious, do people overseas, in Japan, for example, or Asia, or whatever you've heard from, do they anticipate a significant change in American foreign policy?
I, at any rate, have not heard the issue discussed over here in Japan. So from my first personal perspective, I don't think it's a great degree of speculation or thought has been put into it. Again, the midterm election is not followed very closely, at least not over here.
Yeah.
And I personally put very little stock in this. It's just one side of the one-party system taking, or the one-party, two-face system is taking over. So I don't know. I mean, I think there will be some cosmetic differences, and of course there will be the usual kinds of issues that will be pressed. In terms of foreign policy, again, I think that the Asia-Pacific pivot and things of that nature are more military strategic, and those are the types of issues that generally don't get touched when the changeover of power occurs. So I'm not really expecting there's going to be, I mean, if anything, I assume that the expectation would be that there would be an increased push for involvement, for example, in the Syrian-Iraq conflict that's going on right now, or things of that nature, but certainly no easing.
Well,
potentially, but again, I don't think it's so.
Republicans like the sound of marching boots.
Yeah.
Just got that, you know. Give them, love that tuba music. It gets them running. all right. Well, here's another one from Reuters. Oil swoons as oversupply fear extend losses, and they point out that on Monday, Saudi Arabia surprised the market by raising prices for Asia and Europe. Price of Saudi oil going to Asia and Europe costs more, but cutting prices for U.S. customers. Oil slid as much as $2 a barrel in late trade, and the sell-off continued Tuesday, triggering technical sell stops. Phil Flynn, the Price Futures Group, said the Saudis have basically declared war on U.S. oil producers. I think they believe that the only way they're going to survive in the long term is to break the market in the short term. Do you see a declaration of war by the Saudis on American oil producers? Does that seem credible to you?
Well, I mean, it does have a certain logic to it. Now that obviously we're living in the shale oil boom and the really shifting landscape for oil production, but I guess there is a logic to that we can identify. I think ultimately Saudi Arabia's long-term interests are probably going to be better served by serving the Chinese market rather than worrying about the American market. But in the meantime, I suppose they still have to worry about declining revenue from declining American import.
It surprises me that the Saudis would dare to declare war on any element of the United States in a way that's perhaps open, and where you can say, all right, they're just going after the oil companies. All right, maybe, but still, that can't be good for the United States.
Well, again, this has to be seen in the context of a lot of recent moves in the last year or two by Saudi Arabia to if not stand up to the United States, at least show that there is a division there leaves some cleavage for separation at some point. And again, we can look back, for example, the Saudis turned down a UN Security Council seat in protest, basically, over the U.S.'s refusal to go boots in the ground into Syria. So, I mean, again, we've seen that cleft taking place, and I mean it could be increasing at this point. And again, I think it has to do with such things as the shifting landscape for their markets, which is increasingly turning to places like China, which is of course now the world's leading oil importer.
Another article on China from China: draft rules ease limits on foreign investment. This is from Reuters. China is moving to raise its global competitiveness by loosening restrictions on foreign investment in more manufacturing and service sectors. Okay, in a draft of foreign investment catalog, China's National Development Reform Commission cut the number of sectors where China limits foreign investment from 2 for 35 from 79, opening up such areas as real estate, steel, oil refining, paper marketing, and premium spirits. They're going to let more foreign investors come into China. Does that mean China needs that money? I mean, are they just becoming a little bit more modern, a little bit more open, or is China running out of cash? They don't want to sell their gold, and for the moment, maybe they don't want to dispose of their trillions of dollars. They want more foreign investments?
Well, I think they do want to start opening up the country and the currency. I think they eventually are moving towards convertibility of the yuan in order to make it a international currency. And so I think there are moves in that direction. And this has to be placed, I think, in the long-term perspective of the opening up of China since the 1970s and what's taken place since then. And this is actually a fascinating subject that I'm working on a podcast episode that I'm hoping to get out in the next couple of days, that really tries to look at China from this larger perspective of what's happened in the last half century, not just from the time of the Communist Revolution, but more specifically from the time of the passing of Mao and the passing of the reins over to Deng Xiaoping, which was a really important point there in the 1970s, where China started its path towards this new communist capitalist merger mixture, which I think I have quite a lot of evidence to back up, is part of a long-term coordinated agenda between Deng Xiaoping and the other so-called immortals. They actually call them the eight immortals of the Chinese Communist Party in the 1970s, who survived the Cultural Revolution that Mao put in place to come out the other side as the sort of communist capitalists, the red capitalists. And they've been working hand in glove with people like Henry Kissinger and others who have been involved in CITIC, the Chinese state-owned financial investment firm that was largely responsible for the opening up, the internationalization of the Chinese economy, that specifically employed Henry Kissinger as one of their international advisors. It's part of this small clique that's been really pulling the strings in China for the last 40 years that has been part of this move to maneuver the Chinese more into a mixture of this communist command control with the capitalist system into what I think is ultimately the model for the globalist project. The people who are desiring global government really want this merger of command and control, a central clique deciding how the economy is run, but having that capitalist gloss on it, crony capitalism, of course, not really the free market capitalism. And I think that's really what's been desired. And this goes back to the work of people like Anthony Sutton, who I'm sure we've probably referenced here in preceding programs, who wrote about Wall Street and the rise of Hitler, Wall Street and the rise of and the Bolshevik Revolution, who talked about how the ultimate end goal of funding the Nazis and funding the Bolsheviks and funding all of these other sides was to ultimately create a system that would be the merger of these fascist and communist and crony capitalist systems into the perfect governing system for the world, according to these would-be financial elites. So when we put this in that context, this is just one small data point on a much larger graph that shows the picture of how China is being moved into the sort of the perfect governing system from the standpoint of the financial elite.
You talk about looking at a longer term, a larger context. A lot of people seem to regard China as a little bit inscrutable. What are they up to? How do we understand them? Is it possible that part of the mystery that's associated with China is simply a reflection of they think in terms of 10, 20, 40 years, and we're thinking in terms of quarterly reports?
There's some of that in there, but I think some of that has been overblown. There was a famous incident where during Nixon's visit to China in the 1970s, there was a question from a reporter about something about the French Revolution. How does China view what happened in the French Revolution? And Mao said something like, oh, it's too early to tell. And this is supposed to be, you know, this is supposed to be a sign, you know, the Chinese think in terms of centuries or millennia, whereas we think in terms of years or whatever. But actually, there was a misinterpretation going on there, because he was talking about the 1968 Paris uprising, not the French Revolution of 1789. So it may have been too early to tell about 1968 back in the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. And that makes more sense. So I think there's a certain way in which in the West, there's a sort of Orientalism that we tend to look at it as, oh, these are these strange, inscrutable Chinese, and we can't get into their mindset, where some of that might be our own imagining rather than what's actually happening. Some of it, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, China has been a remarkably insular society for most of its very lengthy 5,000 years of civilization. So it has tended to, I mean, it calls itself the Middle Kingdom. It has seen itself that way. It is sort of the center of the world for a very long time, and doesn't care quite so much about what others are doing around it. I mean, it cares more about its own interests, that kind of thing. I mean, we can read those types of things into the Chinese psyche, I suppose, and look at that and see how that's playing out geopolitically. But I mean, there's a whole combination and confluence of things. And I think in our current context, it's probably more valuable to really scrutinize the few families. There are a few connected families that tend to control wide swaths of the Chinese economy. And again, this goes back to those eight immortals, those people who had basically survived the Cultural Revolution, which was a type of purge that Mao engaged in. He basically manipulated the people into revolting against the Communist Party, which was starting to revolt against him. So it was a very calculated political move that Mao made, and quite an effective one, because it got rid of a lot of his opposition. But those opposition that survived that ended up taking the reins and basically started this path. So I think if we see that section of the history, and we follow some of those characters in particular, we start making sense of things that otherwise would be inscrutable.
Here's one that's from Paul Craig Roberts, former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, if I recall correctly, under the Reagan administration. Reagan, I believe that's right. He posted an article, "Vladimir Putin is the leader of the moral world." Vladimir Putin remarks at the 11th. Putin's remarks at the 11th meeting of the Valde International Discussion Club are worth more than a link on my latest column. These are the remarks of a humanitarian political leader, the like of which the world has not seen in my lifetime. Compare Putin to the corrupt war criminals of the White House, or his puppets in office, in Germany, the United Kingdom, France, Japan, Canada, and so on. You will see the difference between a criminal clique and a leader striving for a humane and livable world in which the interests of all peoples are respected. Is that a credible assessment, that Mr. Putin is leader of the moral world?
No, it is not. In fact, that type of rhetoric actually makes me sick to my stomach, to think that this ex-KGB, FSB crony is now being lauded as the leader of the moral world. That's a pretty reprehensible talk, in my opinion. To whatever extent that the Russian face of the would-be power clique is a happier face at this moment, a less menacing face, I suppose that has something to say for it. But the idea that anyone who considers themselves to be in control of the population and the leader of a country and all of this, giving some sort of speech, which is then interpreted as being some shining example of moralism, is about as ridiculous as taking a speech that Obama made about hope and change and how wonderful the world can be and reading that at face value. I mean, there's a difference between rhetoric and what really happens in the world. And the idea that the FSB and all of these, the state apparatus of Russia, is somehow working for the betterment of humanity and not for the interests of the few at the top of the Russian power pyramid is naive at best.
We've got a little over a minute, just a touch over a minute left. What do you think? Is there anything that you think people need to pay attention to that we haven't talked about? Something jump up in the last week or so that you think is important?
There's always things going on, and
try to remember what they are, though.
Here's one headline that I'd like to push out to people. It's RT, actually, Russia Today, just ran a story. Gates Foundation focuses $3 billion agro fund on rich countries, pushes GMO agenda in Africa. Talking about a new report that's just been released by a group called Grain, that has done a really thorough examination of the ways that that the Gates Foundation has spent its money on agribusiness, and some of the alliances like the AGRA, the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa, and CGIAR, and other such organizations that Gates uses to funnel its money into Africa, basically to push U.S. Firm biotechnology on the continent. And this feeds into a phenomenon that's been going on for half a century, really, with the Green Revolution, which was pushed by the Rockefellers back in the day and funded mostly through Rockefeller Foundation funding, which, of course, was nothing other than a ploy to further monopolize the food supply in the hands of a few crony corporate agribusiness biotechnology firms.
We're going to have to leave it go with that, James. We are out of time. Thank you for being on the program. We're going to have to talk about Microsoft's leader or former leader, Bill Gates. Is he a good guy or bad guy? And we'll do that on one of these programs. I want to thank James Corbett from CorbettReport.com for being on the program. I'm Alfred Addisk. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, James, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay.
Ain't it sad?
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.
That's true.